and a lot of cool stuff, science and, you know, biology. And let me make sure that I have everything I need here right in front of me. Yep, all good. All right. So there, I think he's joined us, right? Unable to join. Hello, everyone. Okay, I think there's something wrong with... Hello, Carla. You're here. Hey, what's up, man?
Yeah. What's up, man?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you.
Awesome.
Well, what about you? Do you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly, man. Good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you, too.
Let me just check something with my... For some reason. Now, can you...
What? Not like a couple of seconds ago, right now.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
No, yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's weird. Something weird is happening, man.
It's technology.
And I wanted to do this. It's technology. I wanted to do this just to mess with you. This is my tea, and I know you love it. Milk. Yeah.
Whoa, no, dude. Why? Seriously, why didn't you do
black
that,
tea
man?
And milk. That's how you drink it, man.
Why? Why do you hate me?
I just
seriously.
No, just to mess with you, man. You know, that's how the British drink it.
Why do you hate
it.
Me so much?
Actually, I found out you can jeez. Drink this with lime. So I'm going to try it next time, okay? Just, you know, black tea and lime,
yeah,
no
normally,
milk. That might be better.
Yeah, they normally drink black tea and lime when it's summer. And then they drink hot tea and lime because it's fresh.
Yeah.
When you have some lime, when you squeeze some lime into your tea, it's fresh.
Exactly.
So,
and I can tell
by the way,
summer
good evening,
for
everyone.
Me.
How's it going?
But not for you, right? So it's summer all the time here, but I can tell it's kind of cold where you are.
Yeah, it's kind of cold. I think our audios are not very well synced, so I'm not so sure if our audios are in sync here. But I think it's going to be just fine. So good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. This is another episode of Chá Pedagógico. Hope you have a great time with us. We're going to have some very nice discussion today on the science of bilingualism. For everybody that's joining us on YouTube, good evening, everyone on YouTube. Don't forget.
Thanks for joining.
Don't forget to hit like on the video as soon as we're done with this episode and join us. Don't forget to join us also. For those on YouTube, don't forget to join us on Instagram. And for those of you guys who are on Instagram, don't forget to join us on YouTube later on because
we exactly.
had the previous episodes. So how's it going, man?
Well, you know, it's been busy. Like, I think we're all crazy, working too hard, but... I'm actually kind of glad that we are approaching the end of the first semester. So some schools are kind of quieting down a little bit now. So it's going to be great. And can you hear me okay now? Is it
now
is
I
it
think,
synchronized? Okay.
Now I think it's synced. Now I think it's synced.
Okay. I think it was a connection problem or something. Yeah.
It's technology, you know, so.
It's technology, yeah.
So before we start, Andre, I'd like to say a couple of things that's indirectly related to bilingualism, but not specifically. As many of you may know, today is the Gay Pride Day or the LGBTQ Day. So even though this episode is hosted by two... people who are not part of the directly part of the LGBTQ community. I think it's our duty to make a stand here, not only for this community, but also for every community, because what we've been seeing is a huge negative way of intolerance, a scary wave. So I've always been pro-diversity. I know that as a male, white male, heterosexual, straight guy, I've been a privileged person. I've had a privileged life. I know my privileges. And this makes me try to be a little bit more sensitive about diversity and equality. And
yes,
I don't know if you guys know. I know that you, Andre, you definitely know. 30 days, actually 40 days ago, I became a dad of a beautiful girl. A beautiful
little
girl.
Sophia.
Yes, little Sophia. And I think even now, more than ever, I feel that I should make a stand here for equality.
Yes.
For gender
That's
equality.
That's awesome. Yeah.
For race equality, for whatever equality we're talking about here. We have to make a stand, and we have to know that, and we have to actually fight for equality, for whatever type of equality that we need. We have to fight for it and make a stand. So today we're talking about gender, we're talking about the LGBTQ community, but it's not only about them. It's about equality in general. So, guys.
Most definitely, man.
Equality, one love.
Equality, equality. Yeah.
Equality, equality, one love. And, you know, let's fight for it. We're going to make a stand. So thank you very much for this space. Now let's talk about bilingualism.
Yeah. And let me join you in your stand, because I think it's really important. And I posted today a picture of me and Mr. Trunk. And for those of you who haven't met Mr. Trunk, there he is. And we proudly went to Bristol's Pride celebrations last year. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember being so welcomed by everyone, you know, being around so many different people, diverse people, whose only goal was to be acknowledged and respected for who they are, you know. Yeah. And that made me feel really good to be around those people. And, you know, when I say those people, they are our friends. They are part of our families. Some people are different, but that doesn't make them any less able or inferior to us. And we must respect equality. And I'm here also taking the stand with you, because it's very important for us to fight for those who cannot be heard and for us to speak up against prejudice, discrimination. And you know what, guys? We are going through a horrible period in Brazil. You know what's going on. People are suddenly got this, you know, courage to state their mind, and what they have in their mind is pure garbage. But they're not afraid of saying it anymore. And I hope that we don't have to go through this much longer. I hope that people who think like that go back in the closet, and those who want to be who they are, who want to be loved for who they are, they get out of the closet. That's where they have to be. The ones who speak against them, they go back in the closet. And let's talk about bilingualism. You know?
Let's talk. And actually, before we go get into that, cheers for diversity and cheers for equality.
Cheers, man. Definitely.
All right, guys. So, having said that, today we're going to talk about the science of bilingualism. The whole purpose of this episode here, defining this episode, we were, of course, discussing what are we going to talk about. We've talked about so many things related to language classes, language acquisition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
most definitely.
And then we came to the conclusion, okay, what if we talk about bilingualism, but under the lenses of neuroscience and applied linguistics? Because I think we've never, we haven't talked about this episode, actually about this topic, with this perspective. So I think this is...
I agree.
This is really important. And I'd like to... get my starts here, if you allow me, Andre. Can I?
Please do, man.
Yeah.
And I just want to warn everyone, we're going to be talking science today. You know, it's going to be pretty scientific. Yeah, so get ready. Brace yourselves.
We're going to play Dexter's Lab here today.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So I think the very first thing we have to remember is that when we talk about students who are learning a second language, mainly here in Brazil or in a country where English is not spoken or widely spoken, their native language, there's a big chance that their native language is going to be way more advanced than the second language. Then we're going to have a huge difference between the initial stage of a native language when the person started learning his or her mother tongue and this second language. Why?
Yep.
Because the initial stage of a native language, we call it L10 or L1I. And the initial stage of the second language, we call it L2I or L20, is going to match the final stage of the first language, meaning that our native language is going to be consolidated by the time we start learning a second language. And this can be used as a basis, as a foundation for the second language, because whatever age we're talking about here, but whatever age a person is, this person is going to use the first language as a basis because it's pretty much the only basis, that the only foundation that this person has to compare, to make comparisons and to actually say, okay, so where do I go from here? And this use of the first language, of the native language, when we're learning a second language, can be compared to some characteristics of universal grammar. If we consider universal grammar in a very simplistic way here, but universal grammar that Chomsky, Pinker, and a lot of generativists talk about, it's basically a template that we are born with, and this template is activated through a very simple exposure. So when we're babies, when it comes to first language, when we're babies and we are exposed to a minimum amount of language or a minimum of amount of communication, this template is going to be activated, and then we're going to develop the rest of our repertoire.
Well, exactly.
We do have some questions about this, but when it comes to second language, we have some functions of universal grammar that we can observe in the development of the second language. Because this template that we are talking about for second language is our native language. We're going to use our native language as a template, as a basis for comparison, as I just mentioned a couple of minutes ago. And this is going to be extremely important. This basis is going to be extremely important for the development of a second language.
And you know, it's actually very interesting for you to look at this from a neuroscientific perspective, right? And I have something very cool to show everyone now. I finally got a brain, a proper brain. There you go. So now my brain is finally here. Yeah, this is my proper brain, right? And Rudy was talking about how we use L1 as a template for L2 and the notion of universal grammar. And that has a lot to do with how our brains are built in a way, or how we mature our brains over a very long period, to be honest. You know, we don't fully finish the maturation process till we are in our late 20s. You know, we're still teenagers when we're 27 or 28. We're still in our teens, actually. But the cool thing is that, just like Rudy said, there has to be some kind of foundational structure for the things that we're going to acquire throughout our, you know, cognitive development process, right? And language is definitely, language and speech, which are actually, you know, they're not exactly the same, they're different. So it's there. We are born with that. So it's genetic, it's nature versus nurture. And for us to activate certain genes and for us to actually develop the skill, we need to be exposed to it and use it, or we will lose it, right? So the use it or lose it kind of, you know, dichotomy is applied here as well. And how does this happen? So I can, this is a fully grown brain. So this is the right hemisphere, you know, and what you can see here is that we have certain areas that are slightly different, or we have certain regions of the brain that we can tell that they're apart from the others, you know. Mm-hmm. So this one is very important. This is what we call the temporal lobe, and it's pretty much involved with language. And then we have the frontal lobe, basically this area here. And then we have the parietal lobe here, and this is the occipital lobe, right? And we know that as we are growing up, we are assigning different roles or functions to those parts of the brain. But I'm not trying to say that this part is just going to be responsible for this function. It doesn't work like that. Our brain is very super hyper connected, right? But we know, for example, that if a baby upon, you know, his birth or her birth, they are not exposed to certain things, let's say light, they're not going to fully develop their vision. We know that. And the same thing is true of language. We know that if kids are not exposed to their native language for a certain period, they're not going to fully develop that. But then to say that they're not going to develop a second language because they were not exposed to it when they were kids, that's kind of not, I was going to say a bad word, but you already have language in your brain.
That's boo-boo. That's boo-boo. Yes. Don't curse. That's boo-boo.
Exactly. So you already have the template. You already have it. You have formed the neuronal networks. Now you just have to kind of transfer that to a second language, to an additional language, if you want to call it that way. Just like Rudy said. So it has to do with brain maturation and brain specialization. We know that some areas of the brain are going to be in charge of certain things, right?
Yes. And this this transfer, or these transfers, can be divided into three categories that we call full access, no access, or partial access. Meaning that full access is that we're going to transfer every single instance of the native language to this new language as we are being exposed to it and developing it, or actually acquiring it. No access, no as in N-O-N-U-L-L, like zero access, meaning that we're not going to make any transfer whatsoever. So basically when we're learning a second language, we're going to start from scratch. And then we have partial access to certain characteristics or features of universal grammar, which is something that I really believe in and something that I really try to study and use in my studies, in my writings and essays, etc., which is we're going to make partial transfers. Why? Because the same way when we are learning a first language, we're actually reasoning over the language. It's not the case that we're going to have a language and we're going to basically copy it for the rest of our lives. No, we're going to think over it. You know, we're going to use our brains. That's why we call it cognitive linguistics, in my case, which I'm a cognitive linguist, because we're going to use our brains and we're going to study the whole situation before we start using a language. And we're going to do the same with the second language when our students are learning a second language. And then as they reason over, as they think over this new language, they are going to see the similarities and the differences. That's why we're going to have partial access to universal grammar. It's not full access, it's not zero access, but partial access. We're basically going to reason it. Our students are going to think about this new language. They're going to make comparisons. The teachers, or role as facilitators, is basically to show them the similarities, the differences, etc., 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 which is going to help our students throughout the process. Yeah. This process is going to help by us. We're going to guide them through the process, through showing them, like, okay, so this is the same, this is different. Take a look at this. It's a little bit different from, in this case, Portuguese, because it's our native language here in Brazil, or whatever first language that you have, because I've seen some people from Argentina joining us. So in Argentina, definitely, it's going to be Spanish. But our role here is to guide them through this whole process.
And that has a lot to do with neuronal networks. And I feel like people don't really understand where language is stored in the brain. And they think that there's this very clear dichotomy between L1 and L2 and other additional languages and everything. And it's not really like that. And this is why there are a lot of myths surrounding this idea of bilingualism. For example, what the studies have shown, and I have a couple of studies open here just to make sure I mention the right reference, but there is one by Edna Andrews, and this one is from Duke University. And what it shows very clearly is that when you look inside someone's brain with the fMRI machine, the magnetic resonance imaging machine, you will see that, well, imagine this is the left temporal lobe. Mm-hmm. You're going to see that the neuronal networks that we use for L1 and the ones that we use for L2, they basically overlap. So they're the same. So like Rudy said, so once you have a template, so you paved your way to build language through exposure and, you know, from genetics and everything. Now you can use the same pathways. So you can use the same roads to put L2 on top, because you're not really, you know, adding something different in a different area of the brain. You're actually just increasing your linguistic repertoire. And that's very important to know, because then that will bring us to some concepts we're going to discuss later, like translanguaging, for example. But the idea is, you know, just like Rudy said, so let's imagine that we are native speakers of Portuguese, like we are here in Brazil, and then suddenly we have to learn Chinese, Mandarin. And then there are very significant grammatical differences, right? Yeah. So we're going to be doing something very incredible in our brains, which is transferring the stuff that is similar, that we already know, because we already have the template, but then also kind of going over, rationalizing the things that are not similar, so that we can learn by contrasting. Like, okay, in my language, I say it like this. In this language, like, one thing I know about Chinese, and correct me if I'm wrong, you don't really have verb tenses. So you have a particle at the end of the sentence to indicate which verb tense, you know, if it's past or future or whatever.
Yeah.
So, or you don't have, for example, a question form, like a, so you have a particle that indicates, so this, it's kind of similar in that way.
This I don't know, but the verb case, yes, I've heard about that. And they have like the ending is going to define the tense that's being used.
It's weird for us, right?
And if I'm not wrong, Polish is the same. Polish also has a similar system. If I'm not wrong,
I know Polish is very difficult to even read, because you have like five consonants in a row. And but I can tell you that, you know, in some languages, like we in English, we have the use of auxiliary verbs, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a bunch of auxiliary verbs that will determine which verb tense we're using.
Yes.
And in Latin languages, in the Romance languages, we have a bunch of verb conjugation, so you don't really need to use any auxiliary verb. So this is slightly different.
Yeah.
And so we can't really take advantage of the template, because it's different, right?
Yeah.
But then we can contrast. So it's kind of like you're trying to go to the south of your state, and you're getting, you know, the main road or highway. But then there's a problem, and then you can't really stay on the highway, but you have a bunch of other roads you can take, and you're going to get the same, you know, in the same place where you need to be, right? So that's what is happening inside our brains. Yeah,
exactly. And Anna, hi, hello. She's from Argentina. I remember you. You're from Argentina.
Yes.
Saludos.
Yeah.
and gracias. And thanks for joining us here. She's asking us, does that mean new neuronal connections? Yes or no, right?
Yeah, well, it for example, of course, because languages are never really the same, we have slightly different regions in the brain that you know, that form connections, of course, mm-hmm. you know, but they're pretty much the same as you get more proficient. So what Edna Andrews and Jubin Abutalebi from the University of Vita Salute San Raffaele in Milano, right? So what they found after a very long, like a longitudinal study, a meta-analysis, they found that if you get a person who is a beginner of Japanese, like somebody mentioned here, and then you compare them to their first language, to their native language, you will see that the neuronal networks are not really overlapping because of their proficiency difference or gap mm-hmm. between L1 and L2. But mm-hmm. the more they get proficient, you know, so the more proficient they get, then you will see that those things will overlap with very slight differences because languages are different, right?
Yes.
But in a way, because of universal grammar and having the template, you know, the more you know about one, the more you know about the other, the more similar they will look like in your brain. Basically, that's what the evidence suggests.
Yes. Yeah. And there's also the case I've mentioned here a couple of times. My PhD research proposal is about aphasia, which is kind of related to that. How we are going to rewire the brain, how patients with Wernicke's aphasia rewire the brain after some stroke and after a stroke. And the whole thing in this case, that's why I said yes and no, because yes, it's possible to make new connections, to have new neuronal connections, but it's also possible to rewire the old connections, and which is my whole proposal about that we are going to rewire the connections, because we know that depending on how severe the stroke was, some connections are lost and they cannot be rewired. So they're going to either rewire or make new connections. The whole purpose of my proposal is that. But you, bringing back something that you mentioned before this question about transfers. We have to remember two very important things. There are two types of transfers when we talk about transfers and the comparison between templates here. When we talk about the template, we're talking about a linguistic template, meaning that we're going to compare words, verbs, expressions, collocations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is one type of transfer that we have. And this is a conceptual transfer, which also happens when we're learning a second language, when we are learning whatever language, second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever language. So we have these two types of transfers here. And we have to remember one more thing before we get into transfer. This is my cue for going deep into this matter later on. This is also related to identity. I'm just going to briefly mention identity here. Why? Because again, if we're going to make a transfer, and here in Brazil in Portuguese we say arroz com feijão, there's a big chance when we make use of the linguistic transfer, we're going to say rice with beans.
Yes.
But because it's our identity, you know.
Yeah.
If we go to somewhere in America or somewhere in the UK or somewhere where English is spoken, they're all going to understand rice with beans. But maybe their collocation is going to be a little bit different. And then we as teachers, we have to be careful what we're going to teach our students, how we're going to correct our students. Because if we're If for a background, for instance, my whole English background is based in America. So, and even though I lived in Scotland for a year or so, for a little bit more than a year, I do have a thing or two, a knowledge or two about the English that they speak in Scotland, but not as my whole English background that comes from the US and et cetera. But they're all going to understand. But if I have, if I talk to a student that has a background based in Scotland, for instance, maybe their collocation is going to, his or her collocation is going to be different from my collocation. And I have to be careful with that. It's all about identity, because then, and I'm talking about a student, a Brazilian student that have, that has a background in Scotland and then comes back to Brazil. And then me as a teacher, I have to be careful with this, because that's maybe related to identity. So is it a Brazilian identity? Is the Brazilian identity mixing up with the Scottish identity? And then the this student is creating a whole new identity. I don't know. So this has to be taken into consideration by us teachers when we're teaching whatever age of learners we have.
And, you know, this actually reminded me of teaching English as a lingua franca, right? Because then it's not really... So English as a lingua franca is not really taught necessarily, but it kind of arises in the classroom, you know, like, because we have people who are mixing collocations from different parts of the world, because English has become the new global language, right? And who's to say that this is wrong and that's right, right? Because it's, and then Americans and British people and other native speakers, they might feel that that the way someone is saying something is wrong, but it's not really like that. And to speak about transfers, and this is very interesting from a neurological perspective. So I remember we were talking about counting, right? So this is very cool, because, you know, for instance, that counting and numbers, they were socially constructed. You know, we know that animals don't count. We actually have you know, scientific evidence showing that animals, they can subitize, and subitize is like counting from one to five or maybe seven, not more than seven. So a lion can tell the difference between two gazelles and one gazelle and three and five zebras, because, you know, if five zebras went into the bush and then only three came out, he knows, or the lion knows, that there might be another zebra waiting there. So that's important. But above six or seven or eight, we created that as humans, right? So there is something that we have to be very aware of. So you don't really need to relearn how to count when you're learning another language, because you already have the cognitive schema in your brain. You have the mental model of counting in your brain. So what you have to do is transfer. But the opposite also happens. And to mention very quickly, so we can wrap up this part, there is a tribe in the Amazon, the Piraha, right? That was studied by a linguist, a very crazy, controversial guy called Dan Everett, who challenged Chomsky all the time. So he said he went to the tribe in the Amazon and he studied the people there, and they cannot count, because this, so they were so isolated that this social construct of numbers never got to them, right? And then you, and then they tried to teach them how to count, but it didn't work very well, because, you know, so you would show like five or six or seven or 10 balls, and then they couldn't really see the difference between five and seven, or because they didn't learn that, right? So you can see that the cognitive ability of counting, that is something that we learn in school and you know, with our parents, that's very complex. And it, once we have it, we can transfer to other languages. Because since, you know, the Arabic numbers were created like more than a thousand years ago, languages adopted that. So we just have to transfer, you know, it's part of every language, basically, except for Piraham, right? So we just have, we already know how to count. We just have to be able to transfer that. So it's easier. Exactly. And that's pretty cool. Yeah.
And that's the kind of transfers that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, because this is the concept transfer, which is also part of the second language acquisition process. We don't only transfer linguistic features. We also transfer concepts, mainly, again, when the first language is already consolidated. I'm not saying that the language is going to be responsible for shaping our thoughts. Okay? I'm not doing this. Okay, this is not the case here. This is this is a conversation.
It's controversial.
For another episode, a future episode here. Okay, we're not getting into that. And I'm not saying that
is the chicken and the egg thing. Exactly. You know? And which one came first?
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm also not saying that the thought is going to shape the language. I'm not getting into this conversation here today. We're not getting into this conversation here today.
But
the thing is, we
not today.
Maybe in the future. And if you want us to talk about this, tell us, because then we can make a whole episode on this. Tell us later on, both on YouTube, here on Instagram, and later on Spotify. But the thing is, we do have these two types of transfers here. And these transfers are going to be basically linked to the first language that's already consolidated, which is the main type of bilingualism that we have in Brazil, mainly in Brazil. I believe that in Latin American countries, we also have the same the same scenario. And this is the transfer concept is when I was studying, when I was getting my master's degree, this was kind of a relief for me because as an English teacher, and we've been on the road for quite some time, I'd say. Right? I don't want to say that's been 18 years, but we've been on the road for quite some time, and this is really hard. This was something that concerned me the most because I was like, oh my God, it's so hard. I have this technique. I have to find a technique to make my students get the language, use the language, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I came across this whole material when I was studying, and I'm still studying it, I was relieved because I was like, whoa, wait a minute. So they already have the concept, and this concept is preserved. So all I have to do is to, as a facilitator, as a coach, a guide, my whole role here is to make my student link this concept that's already there to a new language or to a new set of words.
Exactly.
And come on, between only you and me, okay, Andrea, because there's only two of us, right? There's only the two of us here, right? So between you and me, guys, this is much easier than teaching a whole language from scratch, which would be the case of no access or zero access of features coming from universal grammar, which is not the case because the concept is already there. They already know how to count from 1 to 10. They already know how to add and subtract, multiply, divide things. They already know the concept of sunset and the concept of sunrise. They already know the concept of turn right, turn left, etc., etc. So all we got to do is to link, to make these connections.
And I made a drawing here to demonstrate later.
Oh my goodness.
trying to demonstrate that.
Oh my goodness. Man, so, you're not, I've already told you this thousands of times. You're not Stan Lee, bro.
Well, you know.
Stop it.
But just to illustrate when we have a network, basically, we have a bunch of neurons connected in the brain, and they form a network. So you can see that they are all connected, right? And then you have something on the outside of this neuronal network. So we have a concept in our mother tongue, and then we just have to attach this network to this little dot here that is not part of the network because it's the other language, right? And then it becomes, we just connect it, basically.
Just put it up a little bit. A little bit more. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So it kind of looks like a terribly drawn kite, but anyway, so it's you have a bunch of neurons connected, and then you just have to connect another you know, the beginning of a network, and then it becomes part of the same network. And this has everything to do with translanguaging. So for those of you who haven't heard of Ofelia Garcia and the concept of translanguaging, and you realize that we do it all the time, that bilinguals do it all the time, because we have such a bigger, you know, a linguistic repertoire, we can use different words and expressions of different languages when it suits us more or better, because it's easier to access or to express something in that language. And we do it all the time, right? So sometimes, constellation of neurons, I'm gonna say, exactly, right? So sometimes, because of my emotional arousal or whatever, I want to say something, I'm angry, and I'm speaking English, and then I suddenly go back to Portuguese because I've lived those experiences with much more intensity in my own language, so it's easier for me to access those networks. So you, I'm translanguaging.
You don't have to be angry, actually.
Necessarily.
No. I mean, if you bump into something, like you're walking and then you bump your very teeny tiny toe into something, you can be proficient in whatever language, but you're going to curse in your
language. You're going to curse in your language.
Because it's out there. It's easier. It has an easy
access. Because you've done it so many more times that, you know, the network is strengthened. I remember I had a friend at the University of Bristol, a guy from Mexico, Fernando. If you're listening to us, you know, he would be angry or mad at something, and he would say cabron or whatever, just but while he was speaking English, right? And but this is completely.
This is really interesting. Actually, super interesting because, well, based on my last name, probably you realize that I have also an Italian background. And it's so interesting because when I'm actually super angry, but super duper angry, I don't curse in Portuguese. I curse in Italian, which is so curious. I curse in Italian. It's so good.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know, but for me, when I curse in Italian, it's like I'm really cursing, and it makes me feel more satisfied.
Same thing with my wife's family, man. They curse in Italian. They say porco dio and porca madonna and stuff like that. You know, they're translanguaging.
Andre, before you continue on translanguaging, it's really we have to make something really clear here. Translanguaging is not a teaching method, okay? We're not going to teach using translanguaging. This is a consequence of extension of repertoire or mastery of repertoire, all right? Yeah. So guys, if you've ever participated in a webinar, or if you've ever been to a seminar where the person said that translanguaging is a teaching method, oh, I'm going to use translanguaging to teach my students, please make this correction. This is not a method.
They do it naturally.
Yes, it's a natural consequence when we're acquiring a second language, or when we're learning a second language. We're getting into this difference in a minute, but this has to be very clear.
And you know why this happens? And again, it's almost like you can play several instruments at the same time. Mm-hmm. I mean, translanguaging is like being like Paul McCartney, you know? He can play the piano and the bass and the guitar. And then he could play a whole song with different instruments and just play and record, put all together. He has actually done that. And I watched it.
Exactly.
I
was going to tell you this, man. There's a show where he does that. It's super cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. So you can do that. And the same thing happens in your brain when you're translanguaging. And sometimes, you know, like, have you ever seen, I don't know, those street artists playing the guitar and the harmonica at the same time?
Yeah, the famous.
And that's what you do with translanguaging. Exactly. So think of one-man bands, you know, like those guys who have percussion, guitar, and a harmonica, and then they are playing the same note sometimes, but of course, each instrument has a different sound, but they're translanguaging. They're sending the same message, and they're using different instruments, and it's pretty natural, and it sounds beautiful, and we love it, And it's really cool when you hear people talk like that, you know?
Yes. Andrea, one question, dude. Do you remember what time you got reconnected? Because I kind of like forgot to pay attention to the time.
Yes, I think it was like 4 past 6, actually.
Oh, okay.
It was like four minutes past six or something like that.
Yeah, because I was just checking the clock here and I forgot. And I was like, oh my God, because we got reconnected, but I forgot to check. But just to wrap up translanguaging and get into the final topic and to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Translanguaging, remember when we were talking about transfer concepts? This is all about translanguaging, because then when we have our toolbox complete, when we have a whole repertoire in front of us ready to be used, we are basically going to select the one that is more appropriate for a certain situation, for a certain communicative situation.
Yes.
That's what Paul McCartney did with the instruments. He was like, okay, now it's time to play the bass, because the bass now is going to have a role that's really important. And then he plays the bass.
Exactly.
Okay, now I'm going to play the drums, because the drums is going to play a very important role in my music, and so on and so forth. Yeah. So that's translanguaging. Exactly. Why do I curse in Italian? Because for me, the concept of cursing and then in Italian, for me, for my concept of cursing, this has a stronger meaning. That's why I control it. I choose to curse in Italian.
Remember Family Guy. Remember the episode?
Yes, exactly, exactly, you know. And I do have a workshop on translanguaging, and my workshop I also, or that I'm going to transfer to make it a webinar because pandemic, right? And I do use the song Michelle because by the Beatles.
Yeah.
Because in the there is an instance in the song where Paul McCartney uses a French instance, which is Sans les mots qui vont très bien ensemble. Why did he decide to use French? Because that's a romantic song. And then we all know that French is the language of love. It's commonly known as the language
la
of love.
Langue de l'amour.
la langue de l'amour. Exactly.
Yeah.
So he decided to use French because he had full mastery of the language. He could have used English, which is his native language, but then he said, no, it has to have passion. And then he used French. That's the whole thing. And then he comes back to English. That's the whole purpose and the whole point of translanguaging, you know?
Perfect.
And we also have to be careful with translanguaging, not only to mix it up with a method, which is not a method. This is the third time that I'm saying this here because I can't, it's never enough. Translanguaging is not a method, okay? But the whole thing is, the whole concept we're going to acquire in both situations, when we are using, when we're exposed to the language, when the language is being used in front of us, around us, wherever we are, and when we're actually in the classroom having formal instruction.
Perfect.
In both cases, we're going to have the development of a concept, of a linguistic concept. Actually, we're going to have the development of a concept, and we're going to have the linkage. We're going to link the concept to the language in both cases. So we're not here to condemn or to demonize or to make it as a sin. Oh, because learning a language in a natural way is better than in a formal instruction way. No. And the other way around, no, it's not the case here. Okay. Both are just as important.
And you said something very important. Let me show you my brain again, because kids can only acquire a language. That's what people don't get, you know? And then that's, they think that they can, you know, so they want to transfer the concept of acquisition and language learning, but kids cannot really have formal instruction. If you think about it, like very small kids, like toddlers, they acquire the language in a more natural process, in a more unconscious or implicit process, because that's what the brain does, you know? And we know that because when the kid is born, you will see that the brain is smaller and you will see that the neurons are not really connected. So you have the body cell, the cell body actually, and then you have the axon, which is the filament, And then we call this period synaptogenesis or neurogenesis. We're creating a lot of synapses. So we're creating a lot of connections. That's when we have a lot of white matter inside the brain being created. Why? Because we are being exposed to certain things where, you know, we were born with the brain. Now we have to get the stimuli from the environment and make connections. And that's more implicit. That's more unconscious. That's more natural.
Yeah.
And that plays a role. That definitely plays a very important role. But if I'm a grown-up or if I'm an older kid and I have my language, it's there. And I can speak my language, I can write in my language, then I go to school, and then that's formal learning. So that's more explicit. That's more, it's not so natural. It's more conscious effort, right? Mm-hmm. Both play a very important role. So of course, you know, for kids, they're going to acquire more language because, you know, their first language, right? We're talking here. But for adults, they're going to learn more. But it doesn't mean that they don't acquire. I mean, when you put an adult in a situation that he or she is immersed in the language, and then they're going to start making connections without formally learning how to write or they are also acquiring languages. They are both very important processes. They just work in different ways. They use different brain areas. And we have to understand that acquisition is not necessarily better than learning. It depends on many other variables, you know?
Yes.
I think we need to have both situations going on.
We right? do. And just a brief comment here. What's acquisition? Acquisition is when you're exposed to the language and then implicitly you're responsible for realizing when to use a specific collocation, a specific word order, and then you use it. That's acquisition, and you know how to use it. And learning is when you deliberately, when a person deliberately teaches you, okay, so this is a verb, and the verb goes right after the subject, so on and so forth.
Exactly.
We were talking about basketball a couple of minutes ago, right? And I'm going to give you a very nice pass because when I was, I'm going to remember the time when I was a basketball player. I'm going to give you a.
I was a basketball player too. So
So I'm going to give you a fantastic pass. It's going to be in the highlights on SportsCenter later on.
Yeah.
So
all right.
Up, how to pass the ball, and then this kid is going on the playgrounds, and this kid is going to start playing with other kids, teenagers, with other adults, and so on and so forth. And then, as this kid is growing up, this kid is going to be exposed to a more formal instruction of basketball.
Exactly.
And then the coach is going to be responsible for making a fine adjustment, like, okay, so you already know how to jump. But now I'm going to teach you a very nice technique to jump higher. You already know how to do layups. So now I'm going to teach you how to make layup and protect yourself from a person that's trying to block you, so on and so forth.
Exactly.
That's the same thing with acquisition and learning, right?
Perfect. So I love this analogy because, you know, it's part of our lives. And I remember as a little kid playing basketball because I was a huge fan of Michael Jordan's, right? So everybody was, right? Air Jordan, the guy could fly. And anyway.
Who
wasn't, right? And the thing is, I played basketball with my cousins because they were older. And I kind of learned because I acquired it because I was immersed in that environment. But then my mom enrolled me in a school there, like a basketball school. And then I started learning the strategies and learning how to, you know, learning the names of certain passes and how things worked from a more, let's say, the design perspective, like how the game was designed, what I have to do, why do I have to pass the ball here and not there, and why, how do I block and stuff like that, right? And I think that we can have a bunch of people who are natural talents. They have never had formal instruction. But those people don't really last very long in a championship, you know? they don't really go very far because they have to learn how to play the game with the team, and they have to learn how, they have to learn strategy, they have to learn a bunch of other things. And that's exactly, and that's why I love this analogy so much, because a person who has acquired a second language but has never had any kind of formal training will probably never be able to pass the CPE, or, you know, because they haven't really practiced writing and reading at that level, right?
Yes.
They learn how to speak the language. They're natural. They sound almost like a native. But do they have the other skills that they need to, you know, for the championship, like the major, the league, right? Like passing the CPE. So they don't have it.
Yes. And, you know, I don't know if you guys know, both on YouTube, here on Instagram, and later on Spotify, but Andre and I were members of Breast Sea Salt, which is an association for English teachers here in Brazil. And we're also members of a special interest group called Mind, Brain, and Education, which is the MBE, stands for MBE. And we're members of the MBE group. And I'm going to give a very brief, it's not a spoil, but it's a sneak preview of another webinar that we're going to have in October. We're going to have a webinar now on second language acquisition by adults, because we had one a couple of, actually last week, last week. Last week we had a webinar.
Last week,
it's going to be on YouTube soon, but we had a webinar last week on second language acquisition by children, and it's going to be by adults in three months. And there's a study by Meisel, and he says, he actually says in his study that a person that never had both street education or the education coming from life, the society.
Street smarts, right?
Yeah, you know, the person that never had access to both, social interaction and formal instruction. Both are just
definitely
as important. It's important. That's why bilingualism in Brazil is not so good, because we do have formal instruction, but we lack the streets. We lack the social interaction.
You know,
we lack that. We don't have that here in Brazil.
We don't
probably
have
is
that,
the
yeah.
case is the same situation in Argentina, which is probably the same situation in the whole Latin America. But we lack this, and that's why bilingualism in Brazil, and mainly in Latin America, is not very well developed, because we lack that.
Exactly.
So formal instruction plays a very important role, but also the social has a fantastic role in the development of the language, both first, both first and whatever additional language we talk about here.
Exactly. And it's and I'm glad you mentioned additional language, because we're speaking from a very English as a foreign language perspective, kind of like L1, L2, or... But it could be any additional language. It doesn't really matter where you learn the language or the sequence, right? If it's the second or the third, it's just an additional language. And I feel like it's kind of like thinking like this, you know, like kids, they will probably acquire a more native-like pronunciation, because they use it more and for a longer time. And at the same time that they are consolidating their own pronunciation, right? But if you think about adults, they will probably develop more formal operational skills, because you know what? That's the whole point of their studies, I guess. You know, they want to get a certificate, they want to do something. So both processes are very important. We have to have a space for both to happen. And I think we have to kind of debunk the myths, you know, like we have to start learning as a kid, and not necessarily really, you know.
Yeah, we can do it. Yeah, we already have an episode on this. I think it's on your IGTV. It's on YouTube, and it's also on Spotify. The earlier, the better. So check this episode, which is really cool. And I think we have to wrap up, right?
Yes, we have like 1 minute or so. But, I think the message was given, was delivered, right? One thing that we have to remember is that because we have a bigger linguistic repertoire in our brains, it means that we are going to be able to access certain things because, you know, they're the same neuronal networks, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much the similar. And we do have